Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Montgomery interrupted my tangle of mystification and suspicion about 1 o'clock, and his grotesque attendant followed him with a tray bearing bread, some herbs and other eatables, a flask of whiskey, a jug of water, and 3 glasses and knives. I glanced askance at this strange creature and found him watching me with his queer, restless eyes. Montgomery said he would lunch with me, but that Moreau was too preoccupied with some work to come. "Moreau," said I. "I know that name." "The devil you do," said he. "What an ass I was to mention it to you. I might have thought. Anyhow, it will give you an inkling of our mysteries. Whiskey?" "No, thanks. I'm an abstainer." "I wish I'd been. But it's no use locking the door after the steed is stolen. It was that infernal stuff which led to my coming here. That and a foggy night. I thought myself in luck at the time, when Moreau offered to get me off." "It's queer, Montgomery," said I suddenly, as the outer door closed. "Why has your man pointed ears?"
"Is he Vulcan? An elf? Or is he just a dog boy?"
"Will we ever know the answer to why has your man pointed ears?"
"Yes, we will find out as we mount a second expedition to the island of Dr. Moreau by H.G. Wells."
"And we are mounting it like crazy here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer."
"And I'm Chris Lackey. Thank you so much for joining us here on Patreon.
And thanks to that reader, Andrew Lehman of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Please hit up hplhs.org for all the best Lovecraftian musical productions, books, props, garments, and of course, the Dark Adventure Radio Theater productions. You know, folks spend so much time looking at computer screens and phone screens. Take a break from the television screens, pull those lids down over the old eyeballs, and listen to Dark Adventure Radio Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe take the hand of the person lying next to you. Wait a minute, you live alone. Whose hand is that? What an adventure you're having already!
Thank you, Andrew Lehman. The story thus far, a man named Prendick has found his late uncle's papers. They tell an insane tale, which he published for our reading pleasure. The uncle, Edward Prendick, was lost at sea after a shipwreck until he was found by a boat with a drunk captain bringing animals to an island. One of the passengers, Montgomery, is a resident of the island and some kind of scientist. He was actually the person that rescued Prendick from near death due to starvation and exposure. The drunk captain doesn't want to deal with Prendick because he doesn't like Montgomery and he doesn't want to have anything to do with him, including his helper, a strange-looking guy.
And of course, Prendick sassed him.
He did sass him. The drunk captain dumps Prendick in a boat. Montgomery reluctantly takes him to the island where another scientist lives, an older guy called Moreau. There's also a lot of weird-looking dudes on this island that work for Moreau and Montgomery.
Weird as in they look like animal men. And I don't think we're spoiling anything by just being upfront about it. These are animal people. Ferret ladies, bear boys, chicken lads.
Prendick thinks that he remembers Moreau from London as a scientist who was chased out of town for his cruel vivisection work.
Vivisection is the practice of performing operations on live, conscious animals for the purpose of experimentation or scientific research. It's a word used by people who are opposed to such work, vivisection. Yeah. Scientists rarely use this word. It's a pejorative. Mm-hmm. Animal testing remains a hotly contested topic in today's world. Mm-hmm. Has been since science has started doing these things. It's very much the science and the scientific romance here. I think this book takes on a lot of different themes, but vivisection is the core concept that's driving it. Mm-hmm. The British Library has an introduction to this book by Roger Luckhurst, which contains the following. Wells had trained in science and wrote science journalism in the 1890s. He was therefore able to pick up on many humanistic and religious concerns about scientific advances. Dr. Moreau is a character constructed from English fears about new kinds of continental experimental medical science. When these ideas arrived in England in the 1870s, there was a vigorous campaign against the vivisection of animals in laboratories. The first English guide to the subject, called Handbook for the Physiological Laboratory in 1873, was denounced as introducing a new moral contagion into England. And journals like The Spectator, alongside the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, actively campaigned against these techniques. The image of a slightly mad foreign vivisector uncaring about animal pain was fixed in the minds of the English public by the testimony of Emanuel Klein before a royal commission in 1875. Klein was an Austrian who worked at Bart's Hospital in London and professed utter indifference to animal pain, explaining that he rarely used anesthetic. The public reaction to this testimony left many men of science fearful that experimental medical science would never be established in England. Moreau's House of Pain is a direct descendant of these portraits of mad medics, and of course we're going to find out about the House of Pain later.
Yes.
Klein is obviously the model for Moreau, and some speculate Wells took the name from the painter Gustave Moreau. I think he used it because it just sounds like morose. You know, I'm surprised there's not a Darth Moreau, or maybe there is, but it's that kind of, you know, name.
Sure.
There was also another scientist I found in my researches that I thought seemed to just as likely basis for Moreau to me, from around the same era, and this is François Magendie. Magendie was a physiologist in France in the first half of the 19th century who made several groundbreaking medical discoveries, but was far more aggressive than some of his contemporaries about the use of animal experimentation. For example, the discovery of the different functionalities of dorsal and ventral spinal nerve roots was achieved by both Magendie as well as a Scottish anatomist named Charles Bell. Bell used an unconscious rabbit because of the protracted cruelty of the dissection, which caused him to miss that the dorsal roots were also responsible for sensory information. Magendie caught that because he used conscious six-week-old puppies for his own experiments.
Oh, God.
Yeah, while Magendie's approach was more of an infringement on what would today be referred to as animal rights, both Bell and Magendie used the same justification for vivisection, which is cost of animal lives and experimentation was well worth it for the benefit of humanity. I mean, that's the core of the debate, right? Do we care about what happens to some of these animals if it benefits us? Many viewed Magendie's work as cruel and unnecessary. Torturous. One note is that Magendie carried out many of his experiments before the advent of anesthesia, but even after ether was discovered, it was not used in any of his experiments or classes. Even during the period before anesthesia, other physiologists expressed their disgust with how he conducted his work. One such visiting American physiologist describes the animals as victims and the apparent sadism that Magendie displayed when teaching his classes. The cruelty of such experiments actually even led to him being an important figure in animal rights legislation. I won't get into all of that, but there was a very bloody story told by a politician in order to advance this legislation about Magendie dissecting a greyhound in a public theater. Over 2 days, the animal was conscious, and people witnessed this. So I think that's very influential on the chapter we're about to get into. Magendie faced widespread opposition in British society among the general public, but also his contemporaries, including Dr. William Sharpe, who described his experiments aside from cruel as purposeless and without sufficient object, a feeling he claimed was shared among other physiologists. I think it's this purposeless cruelty that ends up being the thing that makes Moreau truly monstrous.
Yeah.
You know, Wells certainly wasn't anti-science. He probably had nuanced views about experimentation, but he was certainly against vivisection. He published an essay called The Limits of Individual Plasticity in 1895, so he directly addressed this. And in that essay, Wells speculates his theories on the plasticity of animals, explaining that the default biological form of an animal may be altered in a way that it would continue to survive even if it in any way no longer resembles its inherent form. This could, according to Wells, theoretically be achieved through surgical or chemical modification. Wells was fully aware, though, that surgical modification is only a physical change and would not alter an animal's genetic blueprint. He made note that should an animal be surgically modified, its offspring would most certainly retain its parent creature's original physical form. So good to know that he understood that.
Yeah.
Because you wonder what he is aware of in this book.
Yeah.
I think that those limits of the plasticity are what Moreau is also dealing with, and that's called out. Later adaptations move the science more toward gene modification. But just some background and thoughts on the man Moreau, since we've just met him. I say let's get into the action now.
All right, well, we're up to Chapter 8, The Crying of the Puma. After asking Montgomery directly about those pointed ears on his servant, Prendick hears a blood-curdling cry from the puma. Montgomery winces as well, so he's not totally heartless, this dude. He's a jerk, but he still has some empathy.
Yeah.
It's coming from the room, this cry, that is the locked door that Prendick is not allowed into.
The puma came over on the ship with them, so whatever's happening to it, this was apparently the purpose of it being shipped here.
Montgomery explains that his pointed-eared servant is from San Francisco, and he's a bit thick, but he's a good guy. Prendick goes, that doesn't explain anything.
It doesn't, but I love that even in, you know, 1888, yeah, he's from San Francisco is a good way to explain any kind of weirdness. Montgomery goes, well, what did the ears look like now? Never really seen them. So again, he's trying to feign ignorance until he has to actually deal with something. The pointy-eared guy with the muzzle, his eyes also reflected green like an animal's on the ship. By the way, so he served breakfast to him earlier.
Uh-huh.
And I was just wondering, like, if a dog boy came in and served you breakfast in this situation, would you eat it? Would you mac down on that?
Yeah.
You would? You'd eat?
Yeah, I wouldn't discriminate against a dog boy.
All right.
What, you would?
Well, I'd have to see what the breakfast looks like.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, if it's got like...
Does it look like a dog cooked it?
Does it have hairs and stuff on there? And like a broken bit of a dog biscuit? And if it looked like it was on the floor, then no, I wouldn't eat it. But if it looked like a normal meal, yeah, of course.
It looks like a normal meal that a dog cooked.
Yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. I really love Montgomery because his tactic is answering a question with a question.
Yeah.
To try and get him off the scent.
But he's a terrible person, but you kind of like him, which is why Val Kilmer was really well cast in this, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Finally, Brendick asks him about the strange men that he saw on the beach. All the while, they can hear this puma screaming as they're having this conversation. They keep trying to talk. Brendick wants to know what race these people are on the beach, but Montgomery, again, dodges the question. Finally, the poor puma cries so much that the men just give up talking. Montgomery leaves, but the screaming continues all through the day. Prendick can't take it anymore, and he leaves and he goes for a walk on the island.
There was a particularly insightful bit of text here. It said the crying sounded even louder out of doors. It was as if all the pain in the world had found a voice. Yet had I known such pain was in the next room and it had been dumb, I believe, I've thought since, I could have stood it well enough. It is when suffering finds a voice and sets our nerves quivering that this pity comes troubling us.
And that gets us into chapter 9.
The Thing in the Forest.
Prendick goes out for a stroll, and it is hot and humid on this island, and there's a jungle. He goes into it, and he happens upon a stream. There, he sees one of these local dudes, strange guys, down on all fours, drinking out of the water with his mouth in the stream. The guy looks up and sees him, and then they just stare at each other for a few seconds, and then the strange man runs off into the jungle.
I think this is meant to be a little more jarring of a scene than it actually was to me as a reader. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like if I was out hiking in Runyon Canyon in Los Angeles and came across a guy drinking out of a stream, I'd be worried about what he was ingesting.
Sure.
But I wouldn't be too surprised by the behavior. I'd be like, I don't know if you want to drink that water. But it's animal-like, and I remember as a kid, you know, one of the first funny things you could do was eat your food like you were a dog.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Lap up some milk like a kitten. So it is a quick signifier of an animal nature.
Yes, yes. Prendick hears something behind him, and it's a rabbit running off. And then he hears something bigger moving around, and he walks away from the screams of the puma, and then he comes across this dead rabbit. Its head had been ripped off. Prendick gets a bit wigged out by this murdered rabbit and moves to an open space in the jungle, and he sees this woman, and there's two men sitting there, but they don't see him. It says they had fat, heavy, chinless faces, retreating foreheads, and a scant bristly hair upon their heads. I never saw such bestial-looking creatures. So one of the men is talking to the other two, but his voice is really weird and strange-sounding. Prendick isn't sure they're even speaking English because their speech patterns are so weird. They get up and they start moving in a circle, and they start chanting rhythmically.
Again, if I was hiking in Runyon Canyon, I'd be disappointed if I didn't see this happen.
He can see that they have a pig-like quality to them.
Okay, now that might get my attention. But I still might think, is it Gamorrean Guard cosplay? Is it a House on the Borderland convention? They have those, right?
Yeah, twice yearly in Los Angeles. He decides to sneak away, but sees that he's being followed by the guy that was drinking out of the water earlier. The guy looks at him, but then he hides in the brush, but he's still hanging around. So he wants to keep following him, but he doesn't want to be seen, even though he's kind of bad at not being seen.
Yeah. Now, that happened to me for real in Chicago, where I was, you know, killing time before I had to meet somebody.
Uh-huh.
And a dude, and I walked down to this park that had trails and seemed well lit and fine with me, but I wasn't that familiar with the neighborhood. And this guy on a bike started kind of following me.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, I didn't like it. So I got off the path and deliberately turned away. And, well, he's not there anymore. And then I noticed he was on the other side of a hedge still following me.
Oh, whoa.
And it was a stop and start, stop and start, stop and start. I took a bunch of turns. I finally emerged out into a neighborhood. I was scared to death because he was a big guy. Like, it was a problem.
Was it John Wayne Gacy?
No, of course not. Oh. First of all, I'm not that old. I mean, how old am I in this situation?
I don't know. You didn't specify.
Well, I was in my 20s. Oh. I came out into a neighborhood and finally he sort of emerged. And I thought, I have to deal with this because I'm like alone out here. I stopped and said, can I help you with something? Mm-hmm. His whole expression changed from menacing to suddenly very nice. And he goes, no, can I help you with something? I was being cruised.
Yeah.
Said no, and I just got out of there. But for that moment of time, it was a little like the scene we're about to have where someone was tracking me.
Yeah.
And I knew it, and I thought I might get killed right now. Right. I didn't know what was going on, you know?
So Pendry can see that this guy's peeking through the vegetation, and he goes to this dude.
This person, too, has the emerald flash in his eyes that was seen and the other animal man.
So he just says, "Who are you?" And the beast guy just says, "No," and he runs off. But he runs off again to like just another bush, and he's still around. And Pendrick totally sees him, but he looks and he goes, "Oh, you know, the sun's getting pretty low, and I don't know if I want to be stuck out here in the jungle with this dude." Right. So he decides it's best to head back, but then he realizes he's a bit lost, and someone or something is still following him, and he can hear the sea, so he moves towards the beaches. As he moves out onto the beach, this thing follows him. Prendick calls out, "Who's there?" And he moves towards it, but this time it doesn't run off. Prendick feels a large rock by his foot, and he gets this idea. So he picks up the rock. Just as he does that, this guy slinks off back into the jungle, and he takes a piece of cloth, and he fashions a sling for the stone.
I would hit myself in the face with that so fast. What a useless weapon.
Yeah, he's obviously had some practice with this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Prendick can hear and see glimpses of this thing just staying within the jungle, but following along as he walks on the beach. So he decides to pick up the pace. The thing picks up pace too. He's getting scared, so he full on runs, and the thing runs as well. And he can see it running on all fours, and then it gets up on its hind legs.
It's a really scary scene.
The stone came out of the sling of the handkerchief as I did so. As I turned, the thing, which had been running on all fours, rose to its feet, and the missile fell fair on its left temple. The skull rang loud, and the animal man blundered into me, thrust me back with its hands, and went staggering past me to fall headlong upon the sand with its face in the water. And there it lay still.
Prendick doesn't check on this thing. He just gets the hell out of there, and he hears somebody calling his name, so he runs towards, there's a light he can see in the distance.
That gets us into chapter 10, the crying of the man.
It turns out that it's Montgomery who is calling him. Montgomery wants to know where he was, but Prendick wants to know what the hell's going on in this island.
Yeah.
Montgomery gets him to his room. Prendick is messed up. He's still recovering from his exposure and his starvation. So Montgomery pours him into his hammock, and he goes, "What was that thing?" "From your account," he says, "I was thinking it was a boggle."
I had to look that one up, even though there's no way we haven't talked about it before.
It's a like a folklore.
Yeah. Did you know it offhand? I actually didn't. A boggle is a Northumbrian and Scots term for a ghost or folkloric being, used for a variety of related folkloric creatures, including shellycoats, barguests, brags, the headly cow, and even giants. They are reputed to live for the simple purpose of perplexing mankind rather than seriously harming or serving them. So kind of more like gremlins, I guess.
Sure, yeah. So Montgomery gives him something to make him sleep, and just then the puma is screaming again. But it's not too long before Prendick goes under. And when he wakes, it's daylight.
He feels kind of hungover, so clearly what he was given was a sedative of some kind. Mm-hmm. He was sedated overnight. He falls out of his hammock and eats a meal that's been prepared for him, starts to feel a little better.
Montgomery comes to check on him, but when he leaves very quickly to get back to work, he doesn't lock the door. And Prendick can hear what he thinks is a puma scream, but it sounds different. It sounds like a person.
The earlier chapter was the crying of the puma. This one is the crying of the man.
Mm-hmm. Prendick is concerned, and so he opens the door to the forbidden room. It is an operating room, and Montgomery tries to stop him from coming in, but it's too late. He's seen everything. Moreau is there working on something.
Again, Prendick does something like telling the captain to shut up on the boat. Mm-hmm. He hears what he thinks is a person in trouble and says, "As I realized this, I rose and in three steps had crossed the room, seized the handle of the door into the yard and flung it open before me." So impulsive action.
Yeah.
If he thinks somebody's in trouble. Says, "There was blood I saw in the sink, brown and some scarlet. And I smelt the peculiar smell of carbolic acid. Then through an open doorway beyond, in the dim light of the shadow, I saw something bound painfully upon a framework, scarred, red, and bandaged. And then blotting this out appeared the face of old Moreau, white and terrible."
Moreau comes at Prendick, and he lifts him up by the shoulder, and he just puts him back in his room, locking the door behind him. "Ruined the work of a lifetime," I heard Moreau say. "He does not understand," said Montgomery. And other things that were inaudible. "I can't spare the time yet," said Moreau.
Into the next chapter, the hunting of the man.
Freaked out by all of this, Prendick decides that he's going to escape. He's looking for something that could be a weapon, but there's nothing. So he breaks the chair, and one of the legs has got a nail in it. So he's like, you know, that'll do.
He's cracked open a chair, but not the mystery of this thing yet. It's the thing that's really freaking him out is that he thinks Moreau is vivisecting a human being.
Yes.
He doesn't realize that this is a transformation in the puma itself, or at least that it's a puma turned into a man. He doesn't get it yet.
No. Yeah, he's under the misconception that these are men turned into animals. That's what he's, when he sees all these animal people, he goes, oh, Moreau has turned these poor guys, these native islanders, into animal people.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why he makes that jumps to that conclusion.
I think he jumps that way just because it seems more likely that you would graft animal parts onto a human than, I mean, to me. Well, I don't know. The only evidence he probably has to go on are Halloween parties. And you've seen, you know, you've seen people wear those cat ears.
Sure.
It's horrifying at first before you realize it's a costume.
That's true.
Why has your man pointed ears?
Finally, Montgomery bursts in, but Prendick makes a run for it. And he calls after him, "Don't be an ass! Don't be a silly ass!" Prendick runs out and hides. There's a small bamboo forest, and he thinks, okay, now what am I going to do? I got no food. I got no water. I have no shelter without Moreau.
And also, they didn't care much about him wandering about the day before, but now they're out to round him up. This guy's having a really hard week, I think.
He can hear staghounds, and Montgomery and Moreau are shouting for him, so he's trapped. And Prendick thinks that maybe they're going to vivisect him, and that death is better than vivisection, so maybe suicide's the way out. Prendick is discovered by this ape-like man who isn't helping out Moreau. He's just kind of, I guess, out wandering around in the woods. And he talks to Prendick and he says, "Oh, you're from the boat." He points to his hands and then he points to Prendick's hands and they both have five fingers. This ape man is really happy about that. It's like, hey, we got something in common. We've got five fingers.
He's emphasizing the commonalities, not the differences. And I think we could all learn from this stranger of an ape man.
He asks the ape man where he might get some food, and the ape man says that there are huts with man's food, specifically man's food.
Yeah.
He guides Prendick through the jungle.
"Eat," he said. "Eat man's food now at the huts."
Prendick tries to make small talk, but the ape man doesn't seem to understand very much. He says that he's very simple and probably not very bright.
The only talk the ape man makes is small talk, like small words, like eat.
He leads Prendick through a cave that opens into a dark ravine with crude huts.
Gets us into chapter 12, The Sayers of the Law.
Oh, man, this part is extra creepy.
Yeah.
"Then something cold touched my hand. I started violently, and I saw close to me a dim, pinkish thing, looking more like a flayed child than anything else in the world. The creature had exactly the mild but repulsive features of a sloth, the same low forehead and slow gestures."
There's a sloth boy.
Oh, sloth boy.
I forgot all about that. I think this might be a little nod to the seven deadly sins, because we're about to get what I believe is a pretty direct parody of religion in the upcoming scene. And so this sloth being one of the seven deadly sins, it was like a little transitional nod to that, I felt. Also, it's just gross.
Which one of the deadly sins is it?
Sloth.
The ape guy vanishes and leaves him there with Sloth Baby. When he comes back, he's got a coconut. And this other dude, he realizes, hiding in the darkness of the hut. Prendick can't see him, but he hears the guy say this, "It is a man. He must learn the law."
That figure in the dark is the Sayer of the Law, which ends up being one of the leads every time this gets adapted. It was played by the one and only Bela Lugosi in the 1932 Precode adaptation of this movie, Island of Lost Souls. My favorite of the movies that have been made from this story.
Yeah.
The character is sort of the religious leader of the beast people.
It's great. I just watched it for the first time. It's a tight 71 minutes long, follows the book, changes a few things, but still rad. We'll talk about that on our bonus content this month. We're going to talk about the film adaptations of this because there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah. There's even a Diana Ross video.
Yeah. There is. There really is. As his eyes adjust a bit, Prendick can see that there are a couple of other people hiding in the dark as well. The bossy one, the Sayer of the Law, barks at them all, "Say the words!" And we get this.
"Not to go on all fours. That is the law. Are we not men? Not to suck up drink. That is the law. Are we not men? Not to eat fish or flesh. That is the law. Are we not men? Not to claw the bark of trees, that is the law. Are we not men? Not to chase other men, that is the law. Are we not men? His is the house of pain. His is the hand that makes. His is the hand that wounds. His is the hand that heals."
And this is, I mean, crazy cult-like stuff here. Prendick knows that they're talking about Moreau. Moreau has created this cult.
"His is the lightning flash. His is the deep salt sea. His are the stars in the sky."
In order to control these creatures, Moreau has created a religion that he is at the center of. And yes, the band Devo was referencing this book with the 1978 classic album, Are We Not Men? We Are Devo. K. conceptually, de-evolution is the what they're referencing with the name of the band, and that's all in this book.
Yeah.
Yes, the hip-hop group House of Pain took their name from this novel.
That's crazy.
Think about that when you're singing Jump Around. In fact, that whiny sound in Jump Around, that wee, ding, 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 wee, that's the crying of the puma.
Oh, wow.
They sampled it, yeah.
And I just thought it was a tea kettle.
It's not.
Learn something every day.
You idiot.
Brenda can finally see the Sayer of the Law, as he's called. He's covered in gray hair, which falls over his face, so Brenda can't really make out what kind of animal man he is, but he's got talon hands.
That's kind of a surprise. Is he supposed to be a bird guy?
I don't know. He takes Prendick's hands. He gets him to say the law with him. Here come all that be new to learn the law. I sit in the darkness and say the law. Evil are the punishments of those who break the law. None escape. And they all start chanting, none escape, none escape. Oh, it's so creepy. Just then, Moreau and Montgomery show up with guns, and Moreau has got a whip. He commands the beastmen to grab Prendick, but he's wily, so he makes a run for it.
Could this week get any worse?
He escapes into the jungle, and he finds a hot spring that leads to the ocean, and he realizes that he's trapped. The beastmen aren't going to help him, and he believes that he's destined to become one of them, so suicide is the way to go. And that gets us into chapter 13, A Parley.
This is the midpoint of the book, and Wells did a similar thing with The Invisible Man, if I recall. It was action and mystery in the first half, just going, going, going. Then explanation and consequences in the second half, pretty neatly.
Prendick gets to the ocean and realizes that killing himself isn't going to work. He just, that survival instinct, it's too strong.
Yeah.
So he's going to sneak back to his room to find a better weapon. He's going to fight. But before he can do that, the hunting party finds him. Prendick is going to walk out into the water to die. And then Montgomery just yells, "What are you doing, man?" He goes, "What am I doing? I am going to drown myself." And then Montgomery and Moreau look at each other. And then Moreau goes, "Why?" So, this part is so funny to me.
Yeah, because it's like parents with their kid being dramatic or something.
Yeah. You know?
"I'm going to run away because I spilled the cereal."
To the why, he says, "Because it's better than being tortured by you." And then Montgomery goes, "I told you so." And Moreau just goes, "Oh, geez." He goes, "What makes you think we're going to torture you?" He goes, "Well, I saw what you did to those, you know," and he points over at the beast people. And at this point, they kind of go, ixnay on the awking tay. But Prendick doubles down. He says, "They were men like yourselves, whom you have infected with some bestial taint, men who you enslaved and whom you still fear."
Oh, boy.
The beast people want to see what's going on. They're like, "Oh, what's he talking about? What is he doing?"
Yeah. He's causing some problems without getting a full understanding of things. Shooting off his mouth, which we've learned is what he kind of does. "I went on shouting. I scarcely remember what. That Moreau and Montgomery could be killed. That they were not to be feared. That was the burden of what I put into the heads of the beast people."
Yeah.
So he kind of knows that he maybe shouldn't have done that. Although he has been put into an insane situation.
Oh, sure. But Moreau starts talking to him in Latin, saying, "Vivisected, a humanizing process. I will explain. Come ashore, you idiot."
Yes. The pig Latin wasn't working, so now he's using Latin. Moreau breaks out that Dracula tactic I mentioned last episode at this moment. "The water just beyond where you stand is deep and full of sharks."
Well, he doesn't believe Moreau. So Moreau, to prove his intent, takes both of the loaded pistols, drops them on the beach, and goes, "Look, you can have these guns. I just want to talk to you." And then he finally points out how stupid Prendick is about all this stuff. He goes, "I never asked you to come to this island. If we vivisected men, we should import men, not beasts." "Obviously. And the next, we were drugged last night. If we wanted to work on you, any mischief, you know, we could have done it then, too. And next, now your first panic is over and you can think a little. Is Montgomery here quite up to the character that you give him, that he's going to vivisect men? We've chased you for your own good. This island is full of inimical phenomenon. Besides, why should we want to shoot you when you've just offered to drown yourself?" Yeah, dude has a lot of good points. And Prendick is starting to see the light here. He doesn't trust them still. So he says, "Go back to the tree line, and then I'll come up and get the guns." And he does.
Both turned and faced the six or seven grotesque creatures who stood there in the sunlight, solid, casting shadows, moving, and yet so incredibly unreal. Montgomery cracked his whip at them, and forthwith they all turned and fled, helter-skelter into the trees. And when Montgomery and Moreau were at a distance I judged sufficient, I waded ashore and picked up and examined the revolvers. To satisfy myself against the subtlest trickery, I discharged one at a round lump of lava and had the satisfaction of seeing the stone pulverized and the beach splashed with lead. Still, I hesitated for a moment. "I'll take the risk," said I at last, and with a revolver in each hand, I walked up the beach towards them.
"That's better,"
said Moreau, without affectation.
"As it is, you have wasted the best part of my day with your confounded imagination."
And with a touch of contempt which humiliated me, he and Montgomery turned and went on in silence before me. The knot of beast-men, still wondering, stood back among the trees. I passed them as serenely as possible. One started to follow me, but retreated again when Montgomery cracked his whip. The rest stood silent, watching. They may once have been animals, but I never before saw an animal trying to think.
And that's it for this episode.
Yeah.
You know, some final thoughts. We'll talk about it more. We're running out of time here. But The religious practices of the beast people really kind of rings true. Mm-hmm. Religion does have this marketing scheme of making you, you know, saying that everything that comes naturally to you is wrong.
Yeah.
And this is maybe a bit why the Oscar Wilde trial came in. The idea that this has something to do with Oscar Wilde comes from an introduction Wells wrote in a later Atlantic edition of the book. It's part of a collection of his writings. I tracked down the actual quote. It says, "The Island of Dr. Moreau was written in 1895, and it was begun while The Wonderful Visit was still in hand. It is a theological grotesque, and the influence of Swift is very apparent in it. There was a scandalous trial about that time, the graceless and pitiful downfall of a man of genius, and this story was the response of an imaginative mind to the reminder that humanity is but animal, rough-hewn to a reasonable shape, and in perpetual internal conflict between instinct an injunction." This story embodies this ideal, but apart from this embodiment, it has no allegorical quality. It is written just to give the utmost possible vividness to that conception of men as hewn and confused and tormented beasts. When the reader comes to read the writings upon history in this collection, he will find the same idea of man as a reshaped animal, no longer in flaming caricature, but as a weighed and settled conviction. So that's what Wells was thinking about much later on the topic of this story. And I believe what he's trying to say is that, you know, Oscar Wilde wasn't doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
Injunction, you know, but the law cracked down on him. I believe that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
There was another bit from that British Library introduction about de-evolution, which came up here. It says, "The key elements of the story derive from the theory of degeneration that so preoccupied the intelligentsia at the time. Charles Darwin's Origin of Species had upset mid-Victorian Britain, but the book actually ended with an extremely positive exhortation that man was evolving always upwards toward perfection. By the 1880s, the message was not so optimistic. One of Wells' zoology teachers, Edwin Ray Lankester, argued that if it was possible to advance up the evolutionary scale, it was equally possible to decline, to move from the complex to the simple. And this biological theory chimed with moral panic about the decline of civilization and the pattern of decline and fall that haunted the British Empire even at its largest extent. The Island of Dr. Moreau tells a bleak story about the impermanence of moral and intellectual advances and the inevitability of decline. Without Moreau to command the beast men, they all inevitably slide down the scale, back towards their bestial origin. The implication is that we are never far above bestial origins. That the men of science can now manipulate the boundary between the human and the animal only further blurs the lines." And Edwin Ray Lankester's Degeneration, a chapter in Darwinism, the book, examined how evolution, including social or behavioral evolution, might be degenerative, especially where food and safety from predators were easily acquired. So that's the fear.
Yeah.
If we all have it too good, are we going to start turning into dumb animals again?
Yeah.
Because we didn't have to use the brain to strive for anything.
Exactly. And that brings us back to the time machine with the Eloi and the Morlocks.
Oh, yeah, you're right. So and Morlock and Moreau are kind of related words. I think that this is something that Wells was thinking about all the time in this period. Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't wait to keep talking about this book. I'm totally loving it. It's so good. It's so much to chew on, and it's freaking scary.
This section that we just got through is definitely horrifying.
Oh, yeah.
Before you know the nature of what any of this is, you know, he's just trapped on this island being pursued by monsters.
Yeah. But you know who's not a monster? Andrew Lehman.
He's not even close. He's
what's the opposite of a monster? An angel?
Well, I would say it's Andrew Lehman, which means, as we've learned, manly the man.
Andrew, thank you so much. And please go to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society and check out all the rad books. They've got so much stuff there. Audio dramas, props, anything your heart desire. Just really
They've got so many cool shirts and garments and things like that. And man, I just love those guys. They make such cool stuff.
Yeah, they're great.
We're privileged to know them. I also think that we're privileged to know some of our patrons who support this show. We really need the help and we really appreciate it. I want to start by thanking Michael Sofka.
I'd like to thank Jesse Fish.
Michelle Stewart, thank you.
Harrow X, thank you.
Lizzie Timbreza, thank you so much.
Thank you, Struggler. Aw.
I relate to Struggler.
Oh, poor Struggler.
Christian Havener, thank you.
Michael Calvin, thank you so much.
Christian Valbo, thank you so much.
And lastly, Peter Beverwick, thank you.
You guys are the best, as I say, we really need the support, so it's much appreciated. We're going to have more Island of Dr. Moreau next time. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.